Hi there, my name's Jeremy Thomas, and I am the host of Shed Talks. Shed Talks hopes to be an entertaining, informative podcast that looks at well-being and mental health. And I hope you're going to like it. I'm going to be in conversation with well-known, interesting figures. Now, when it gets to the end of that conversation, don't rush off, because we have got the illustrious, wondrous psychologist Karen Cowan on hand to discuss what's been said and to give us some insight and various tips on what we can do with our mental health. It's all going to be great. Enjoy. Welcome to episode 6 of Shed Talks. Our guest this week is a man who positively enjoys standing up to be counted. A man whose life was turned upside down by tragedy in 2011, yet came to believe there is a silver lining within even the darkest of clouds. He played rugby for England, a father of 4, a husband of 1, and has loyally supported Fulham Football Club for more than too many years. He was headmaster of a prep school for over 22 years before eventually becoming arguably the best top speaker on good mental health in this country. A highly cheerful and emotional man who has never, ever, ever been known to pass up on an offer of a bacon sandwich. Welcome all round good egg, Dick Moore.
Thank you very much, Jeremy, and it's a pleasure to be in your shed.
It's great to have you. Really, really good. And I think we're going to have a really good, interesting chat. You were brought up in Ladbroke Grove in London and in Wimbledon.
Yep.
And you had a pretty good childhood, I understand.
Virtually idyllic, one or two moments, but pretty good. Yep.
Great. Okay. All right, and you we speed on, and you went to a prep school that it was known as a very high-achieving school with a very demanding headmaster, and I use that word carefully, and you didn't like it.
No, I think with hindsight, I definitely did not like it. I was astonished I got in the first place, and I think it must have been some sort of backhander that my parents offered this particular tyrant called a headmaster. He owned the school, and he measured his and the school's success really purely in terms of the number of Winchester scholarships it got each year, and in terms of its first 15 rugby results. I was never going to contribute to the Winchester scholarship list. In fact, I spent most of my time trying to get towards the top of the B set, but I was good at rugby. However, whilst I loved the rugby, and there were elements of the school that really, really I loved, I was absolutely terrified of the headmaster.
And he was very keen on beating people.
He was very keen on beating people if they didn't get more than half marks in the Latin test, or if they hadn't learnt the colic correctly, or if they'd misbehave in any sort of naughty way. And many boys, as it was all boys then, saw being beaten as sort of a badge of honour. I saw it as terrifying. And I can remember standing, sort of almost hiding round the corner from his study, waiting and physically pulling my hair out, which I guess is an early example, looking back, of self-harm.
Mm.
I hadn't really thought about that. In fact, I hadn't thought of the whole nature of my time there and what it did emotionally to me. The headmaster liked me because I was very good at rugby and because I had a very pretty sister who he fancied and yes. behaved inappropriately with. But I was terrified of him.
Yes, and you know, is it true to say that the self, you know, I don't want to sound like some purient sort of git, but you know, that the self-harm, you know, went deeper in terms of you, you know, swallowing things.
Yep. No, I'm undoubtedly, when about 10 years ago, I went back to my father because I'd suddenly wanted to learn more about self-harm and emotional and mental health. And I went back to my father, who was very old at that point, and I said, do you remember that little boy who, aged about 10, swallowed a fishhook, a pencil sharpener, a marble, and a piece of glass at school? And he said, yes, yeah, I remember that really well. We never knew what was wrong with you. Me? Jolly Dick Moore? No, surely he can't have self-harmed. But I did, and that really, it was all an effort to escape. And when, unfortunately, those particular items reappeared with monotonous regularity, I resorted to faking my appendix. And eventually had my appendix removed in a hospital which was run by nuns. I was in a ward with six girls who were a bit older than me. I must have been 10, I guess.
Gosh.
I can vividly remember the music, Gary Puckett and Union Gap.
Oh, yes.
Marmalade, It's the Loving Things You Do, playing. And I think that had a very profound impact and a lasting impact on the person I am or I'm not today.
Yeah, well, I mean, but that's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, did it ever occur that you were able to say, I really don't want to be here, I wish to leave pronto donto? Or was that just not a discussable option?
It wasn't. You know, my parents were lovely, and I have nothing but love for them. And they clearly thought this was going to be the best school, it was a very good school.
Yeah.
But no, I just needed to escape, and having made a thermometer explode by putting it on the light bulb to try and get a temperature, I clearly decided that I needed to do more drastic things. The embarrassing thing, looking back, is that the stories I told to explain why I'd swallowed a fishhook or a pencil sharpener were so completely fatuous as to think that anybody, any self-respecting parent, would have believed them and not said, what on earth's wrong?
Yeah.
But I think back in the late 60s, one didn't do that sort of thing.
Well, I suppose there's an element, we do hope he's going to grow out of this phase. And,
Yeah, I'm sure.
But interesting, isn't it? Anyway, you survived by being a really good rugby player, and that stood you in great stead to get into Cranleigh and zoom up the ranks of Cranleigh, again with rugby being a big deal.
It was a big deal. I did enjoy my time at Cranleigh. I think I would have enjoyed it more at home, but Cranleigh at that stage in the early 70s was quite pioneering in terms of changing from being a rather violent hotbed of fagging and unpleasantness to being somewhere that was more akin to schools today. It wasn't harsh, it wasn't frightening, but because I was good at rugby and played above my year group,
yeah.
Some of the older boys saw me as something between somebody who needed to be put in their place and yet somebody who was quite admirable too.
Yes.
And that gave confused messages all round, I think.
But something that sorted your self-esteem out in the sense of gave you quite a great position.
Unquestionably.
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting what goes on with schools and hierarchies and, you know, feeling less than in many, you know, departments and feeling, hello, I'm actually okay because I am, you know, I'm the best painter in the school, or I'm the best cricketer, or I'm the best. I remember people in my school, there was one chap who was a very good actor. He was pretty hopeless at everything else, but he was a very good actor. So, of course, he sort of took on a Richard Burton, you know, persona. And everyone said, oh, God, I suppose so. He's all right then.
Yeah. Well, you've got to have something, haven't you? And I think one of the things with some of my children is perhaps I wanted them to have something too much and probably put the pressure on them to find something. What I didn't care whether they were good rugby players or artists or musicians, but they needed, I felt we all need something. And certainly for my self-esteem, it was rugby. And I really feel for those young people in their final years at school who have been denied that opportunity to use their one great sporting skill or musical skill or dramatic skill over the period of COVID. I think that's going to have a really profound impact on people over in the years to come.
Yes, well, I'm sure you're right. I mean, but I think it's still the same thing, isn't it? That we have to, you know, look to help people whose sort of battery charge is low, and to find something that's going to really increase it. And something, you know, there are some things where you actually do need real talent. And you know, you had it with going out and playing for the England schoolboys in South Africa, which, I mean, it has got to be, you know, pretty groovy, especially considering we're, you know, British Lions are about to play South Africa now, and you did your own version to it early.
Yeah, and you know, we even had a couple of Welsh boys in the team, could you believe?
Did you?
You know, I know, outrageous, outrageous. They weren't very good, of course, but no, but it was interesting because it wasn't, I need to stress, it wasn't an England schools under 19, 15.
Yeah,
it was
it
was chosen from a selection of players from English public schools.
Yeah.
And of course, going to South Africa was not at all popular with some members of my family.
Your mother?
My mother, absolutely, who had spent the war years out in what was then Rhodesia. And when I received the letter inviting me to go on this tour, I can remember it vividly, in the kitchen in Drax Avenue in Wimbledon, and my father was eating his boiled egg with his toasted fingers, and as I said, oh wow, I've been selected to go on this tour, and I could see my father was chuffed. My mother, standing by the sink with her guardian, said, what a shame. What a shame it can't be to Australia or New Zealand, because then, of course, you could go. And I said, what do you mean? Well, he said, you can't go to South Africa. It's an appalling place, the regime, and da-da-da. And I said, well, of course I'm going to go. Anyway, seconds later, I'd been hit over the head with her guardian and called a fascist bastard, which has gone down in family folklore.
I'm sure it has. She was right.
She was right.
So, you know, basically you did school, did all that, and ended up going to Durham University. I can't do a Durham action, never mind. Which is a very nice university. It has a very, very beautiful cricket ground, as I remember. Mm. And how was that? Was that great fun?
Yeah, it was good fun. It was good fun. I'd met my wife-to-be before going up to Durham.
Gosh.
Therefore, most weeks after playing rugby, I would jump into my little blue Mini and drive 300 miles from the Durham Racecourse rugby ground down to West Byfleet and then come back on the Sunday. But it was fun.
Yeah. Sounds to me that you were very single-minded in a positive emotional way, in that this was, you know, thank you very much, the one for me. And yet you were quite young.
Yeah, no, I've always wanted things to happen quickly.
Right.
Right the way through, I've wanted to get to the next bit and the next bit and the next bit. And with hindsight, has that been helpful? Well, I didn't have any of the rather sordid romantic adventures that my friends had at university because I was attached. With hindsight, I wouldn't have become a housemaster or a headmaster quite as quickly as I did, because you suddenly find yourself running out of energy when you're still only in the middle of your life. But I think if I see something and I want it, I tend to go for it. Yeah, provided and it's not too difficult.
And was it important to you? I mean, that sounds a daft thing. Let me put another way. I think a lot of most people deep down, want to find someone they can be with on a long-term basis. They also want to do something that's, you know, hello, that's me. I've achieved this. I'm really great.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. I met my wife, Sheena, on a blind date at a rugby club dinner dance at Sandown Racecourse. Was it love at first sight? I don't know, really. I can't really answer that. But what you say about wanting to achieve something is absolutely right. And to find somebody that you think, it's like having a rock in your life, isn't it? Somebody who is there to look after you, to tell you when you're being an idiot, to put things into perspective, and all that stuff that I really need, much more possibly than some of my friends. I need somebody there.
Yes.
Whether that's insecurity or just laziness, I'm not entirely sure.
Yes. No. Well, I mean, but some people do and some people don't. And some people know that they want it. And some people don't know. But you did, and it all worked out. And you ended up coming out of... Sheena came to live with you in Newcastle. So when you finished Durham, you went to Newcastle, teacher training course in Newcastle University, and there is Sheena with you.
Yep, that's exactly right. She wouldn't come to Durham, despite my best efforts, because she wanted to read some daft subject to do with physics and astronomy and all that sort of stuff. So being a horribly independent mind, she said, no, I'm going to Newcastle. If you want to live with me, you come and live in Newcastle. So I did.
That's absolutely brilliant. I love it. Anyway, so the great news, you got married, Sheena, hooray! And you then joined a prep school and in the end became the headmaster of the prep school.
Yep. When we got married, I went to a senior school first, where I was taught English, coached rugby, and became a housemaster. And then 7 years after that, went into the prep school world, became head of a co-ed day and boarding school down near the south coast called Forres. And I basically did that for nearly 23 years.
Amazing.
I stopped when Sheena told me one day that I was becoming grumpy and unpredictable. That's when I thought, enough's enough.
Enough's enough. But during that time, if I'm not completely mistaken, you have... had four children.
Yes, four boys.
Four boys.
And God, that's been a learning curve, as it is for any parent. All entirely straightforward, well, not straightforward, but nothing remarkable. A couple of them were really good at sport. A couple of them were quite clever. One had a really good sense of humour. But all very, very different. And that is also something that's triggered my interest. How can children born of the same parents be so different?
Yes, fascinating.
And yes, they in their teenage years, they really put us through the ringer. We had incidents with them. We had an incident with a police helicopter in the hills above Marlborough. Which was quite entertaining. Quite entertaining in hindsight. We had my oldest being invited to consider alternative accommodation midway through his career at Marlborough. We had my youngest deciding to stockpile laptops illegally and also was invited to consider alternative accommodation. But with hindsight, they were all normal kids.
Yes.
And, you know, actually, it was part of an education as adult to see that life isn't straightforward with one's children as it isn't straightforward for oneself.
Yeah, sure.
But it did cause me quite a lot of heartache and quite a lot of emotional, almost emotional trauma, I guess.
And was that, did that, you know, I mean, we're going to get to the meat and potatoes of this in a second, but was that and the sort of burnout of being at school, what, because you had a bit of a dip, gloom, didn't you, you know, at the end of the your time at the being the headmaster of the school, 2009?
Yeah, everybody thought I'd been in post since 1993 effectively,
yeah,
and gone through some tough times economically with the school, but everything was great, everything was hunky-dory. Everybody thought Dick Moore was great and it was lovely and their kids were happy and da-da-da-da-da. And then when my own kids started playing up, I found myself becoming grumpy and unpredictable, and that actually I wasn't really enjoying it. I was becoming stuck behind my desk rather than getting out and exuding bonhomie and enthusiasm. And in fact, one day I was sitting behind my desk and I suddenly found tears rolling down my cheeks. And I thought, what the hell? So I got up, went out, walked across the road into a field and was just crying. Right. And that, as far as I can recall, marked the beginning of a time when I felt just frankly bloody miserable. It was my big sister who way, way back in her 20s had been through a pretty serious psychiatric dip, told me to go and see the doctor because I might be depressed. And I said, don't be ridiculous. I'm Dick Moore. I don't get depressed. I've got everything I could possibly want in my life.
Yeah.
Anyway, I did. He sent me to a delightful psychologist who talked to me ostensibly about football and rugby and being a bloke, but yes, in fact was giving me a bit of cognitive behaviour therapy, and talked about pattern break. And I think this is a key moment in my life. He said, okay, you need to change something in your life. What can you change? Can you change your children? Well, no, not really. Can you change your wife? Well, I don't want to change my wife.
Right.
What can you change? And I thought, well, I could change my job, I suppose. And a week later, I handed in my resignation and never looked back from that moment. I was suddenly felt free, relaxed, calmer. I enjoyed being a headmaster again for the next year until I stopped. I had a ball.
Amazing, amazing. So he wasn't saying the pattern break was don't repeat the same pattern.
No, because I think you realise that, you know, your kids are your kids. You can't have that time over again. And your career is your career and you can't have that time over again. And I think it was a very wise thing to say. And I feel concerned if anybody can't change anything in their lives. We were lucky to be able to take our early retirement, financially lucky. And I think for those people that feel really stuck, that must be truly frightening.
Yeah, that is very, very interesting. And, you know, and I'm just interested in one tiny point, really, and don't take offence by this, that, you know, I think you are an emotional person, and I mean that in a positive way, in the sense that, you know, you almost have I think one of your legs is Italian. but, you know, I think the aspect of people crying is quite an important thing. You know, it's so ingrained not to do that at any cost if you're male. Well, I was anyway. And I think actually it's that funny thing. And I don't know, maybe you didn't have any control over it at that time. But it's an interesting thing, isn't it, that actually it can be such a release.
I think, Jeremy, I mean, this is a massive point you raise, because we all know what emotional pain is, whether it's the fact that the dog's not very well or your partner's dying, or, you know, it can be any number of things and nothing. And we get clogged up with this horribly painful emotion and we have to find a way of getting it out.
Yeah.
Now, it might be that we can go for a run or play the guitar or make something or get a garden shed and start doing talks and but we all need something. And for me, I can't do any of those things. I can't draw, I can't paint, I can't make things, I don't want to make things. And I'm lucky enough to have a partner that I can really pour my heart out to. That's number one. Crying was a savior for me. And when I talk to young people about crying, I can see some of the boys are really puzzled that here's this blokey bloke who played rugby, drinks beer, season ticket holder at football, crying. Really? Oh, yeah. Yeah, brilliant. Have a cry. You'll feel better.
Yeah.
And I think that whether or not it's crying or something else, we all need an emotional
release,
an outlet, a tap.
Yeah. No, I think it's, amazing. Anyway, let's move on. So back to the kids. If any of your children were going to have problems, would you have imagined it would have been Barney?
Yeah, he would have been number one on the list. Dom, our oldest, if there were going to be disciplinary issues or problems outside the family, then he was never a great decision maker. But Barney was anxious from day one, and a very normal bloke. I mean, he was regarded by his many friends as being really cool. And he was quite sporty, and he was good looking. But he was the guy that would hide in the rhododendron bush when the school bus was leaving to take his year group to France. Or he was the one that didn't want to go to a party. Or he was the one that would run straight for Sheena when left at school. He was very emotional. I hate saying children are sensitive, because every child is sensitive. But he was outwardly sensitive. He found it difficult to communicate.
With everybody or just with...
He would get embarrassed trying to communicate with people he didn't know. He would just feel really awkward. And even in big groups of mates, he would always be sort of not on the outside, but on the periphery. I think that we knew that Barney had emotional challenges. But really, we thought no more than a lot of the other children we'd come across.
Yeah, so was it something that you thought would come out in the wash?
Yeah, we thought, well, you know, he'll grow up, and we gave him choices about where to go to school and all this sort of stuff. And I guess, you know, we were only learning about bringing up children.
And
of course, we'd seen a lot of children through school who'd been difficult, awkward, troublesome, troubled, who emerged as delightful young people later on. And Barney was always delightful. He was never difficult or, awkward at school. He worked quite hard. He had friends. He liked his music festivals.
So when he was about 18 or 19, I think things started to go slightly, awry.
Well, when he was, even when he was 15 at school, we found out later that he had been trying to contact girls on the internet. And he had a bit of school phobia around the age of 15. And that was difficult. He refused to go back to school. We got him back in to take his exams, but that meant he had to sit on the footwell of the car so nobody would see him come in. It's rather like, and I get it, I can empathise with this. If you've taken time off school, going back in amongst your friends with everybody saying, "Oh, hello, Barney, how are you? Where have you been?" is quite threatening.
Yeah.
But he then found, when he was about 16, a local girl on the internet who he got together with, and she helped him get into the local state school to do his A-levels. Right. And we had two calm years where he was, if you like, in normality with normal kids and with this delightful girl who helped
him. And that was all local, and he liked the school and liked her a lot, and she liked him.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. So what happened?
It didn't lie. I don't know why, but in his gap year, that sort of faded away. And he did some good things in it. He went off and became a master scuba diver, and was apparently really, really good, became a scuba diver instructor. And we thought, oh, that's interesting, because, of course, as a scuba diver instructor, you're communicating with hand signals, with goggles and something stuck in your mouth, and people can't really see you. And he was really good at that. sort of non-verbal communication. But then he met another girl on the internet who was just delightful. And they fell madly in love and went out with each other for, I don't know, probably a couple of years. And Barney undoubtedly had thoughts of marriage and long-term relationships.
How old was that? Turned 20 by then? Or?
Yeah, he was, that would have been, 19. Yeah, 19-ish. And then in about June, when he just had his 21st birthday in May, she ended that relationship. I don't know why. Not interested why, because it happens. I certainly don't blame her.
Right.
And Barney, unlike most of us who would be really miserable for a while, Barney went into a flat spin and didn't want to talk to anybody, didn't want to listen to anybody. All he wanted was to get her back. And he became utterly obsessed, disconnected with everybody and everything. He became bleak, dark. And it took 6 weeks of trying to get her back before the penny dropped. Actually, she wasn't going to come back. And and actually, why should she come back? He had no right to expect her to come back. And when he realized that, he obviously thought that was going to be a permanent misery. Or he felt guilty about something or whatever. And he decided he couldn't cope and he was going to kill himself, which he did.
Right. Did you think two things? Do you think before that he is seriously depressed?
Yeah.
And therefore that's a possibility that he could.
Yeah, he had told us. He had told us pretty. I mean, a couple of weeks beforehand he had gone off. Just trying to get the timeline straight. He was utterly morose living in this posh girls' boarding school where we were living, and sat with his hoodie in his room with his laptop. And I had, he had threatened to kill himself.
Right.
And had been picked up by the police and delivered home. And he was very, very angry. I took his car keys, and that made him angrier still. And eventually I gave him his car keys back. He got into his car. I handed him a note through the window telling him we loved him and that we were going to be there at all times, in all cases, which he just gently brushed off and drove off. And that, as they say, was that. He was found in a hotel room in Reading, having left a message for a delayed text message or something for the ambulance service saying where he could be found and could the ambulance people come before the domestic staff came in. So he was still a little bit considerate.
Yes, absolutely.
And I can remember being summoned to the school office to see two policemen, or a policeman and a policewoman, who broke the news that he'd been found dead.
And were you very surprised?
No. I had asked Sheena probably a few weeks before whether I thought that his threat to kill himself was something we should be taking really seriously. And she'd said, well, of course we should take it seriously, but I don't think he will. I think he's just being manipulative. I think he's using that threat to try and get the girlfriend back.
Yeah.
And I said, well, why wouldn't he? And, you know, it's interesting. There's a statistic that's quite recent, which is that over a quarter of 24-year-olds have at some stage contemplated suicide. Now, that doesn't mean they're suicidal, obviously, but it means that they've needed to escape from something. And that is one pretty extreme option. So I thought if I'd been in his situation, I would have contemplated it. And therefore, why shouldn't he? And he was pretty bloody stubborn and manipulative. And therefore, I wasn't surprised. I was still shocked, obviously.
Yes.
But I wasn't surprised, no.
Gosh, yeah. Was there any point where, in the sort of 6 weeks prior that you could get him to speak to anybody, you know, therapist, counsellor, you know.
Yeah, we when he was back in his sort of GCSE year, when he had his first big blip, we did get him to go and see a therapist, and she did put him on some mild antidepressants, but he wouldn't engage in the talking therapy. And as you will know, just taking antidepressants without the talking therapy is pretty fruitless, really. And we tried very, very hard. In fact, there was a woman, a delightful woman called Mandy Saligari, who was doing a talk at the school. And Sheena went to listen to the talk, and it was just about well-being. And this woman very kindly offered to come back and talk to Barney. But he wouldn't see her. No, thank you very much.
Why do you think that was?
I think he would have been embarrassed. He would have thought there would be no point, because he would have thought that his relationship with his girlfriend and the pain that he was feeling following its breakdown was something that there's only one person could do something about, that, and that was the girlfriend. Nobody else could tell him how he was feeling, or that he would feel better in time. And that's why I often call, you know, my talk something like All Storms Pass or Dancing in the Rain or, you know, because I think when you're young, we as adults who've been through stuff can say, you know, it'll be okay. It's bloody difficult now, but it'll be okay. But until you've actually been there and done it and know that it can be okay, why should you believe anybody?
Well, I mean, you know, in sort of classical terms, a broken heart can be a terrible thing. And, you know, Ophelia and Hamlet.
Yeah.
And it can be this massive. But, I mean, I think most of us who've been through, you know, bust-ups, breakups, which all happen to everybody, you know, might go, well, I'm not talking to anybody about it because I am embarrassed. I don't want to look more of a git than I am.
Yep.
But I will talk to Ted because he's my best mate. And I, you know, I'm gutted, Ted. Tell me, talk to me.
Well, I say to young people now and to parents and to teachers that everybody needs somebody with whom they can engage to help them think through the emotion. And you know that, you know, the limbic emotional brain is still fairly immature at 21, and our emotions can hijack it, and we all need somebody that we can listen to, lean on, cry on, talk to. And I think some people find that really difficult, and Barney, I don't think, had that person. He had plenty of willing takers. His godfather was really tried very, very hard to help. We did, obviously. But no, he didn't want that. And a lot of young people's parents say to me, what can we do? What can we do? And sometimes the answer is, well, actually, you know what? There's not a lot you can do until your young person decides that they want to get some help. They want to get out of this, and that they start believing that there may be somebody out there, a best mate, big brother, Uncle Bob, a therapist who will be able to help them. But Barney didn't get to that place.
Yes. See, to me, and I'm not trying to box this situation off, but it does relate back to a lot. You know, when you think about the whole idea of self-esteem, how we value ourselves, and that if you put all your value in a relationship, that, you know, that's it, everything, all money on, you know, red or black. This is all my money's going on it. That when it goes wrong, then obviously, and I mean, you know, we've all been there, and it is sometimes, you know, for 2 weeks, it's the end of the world.
Yeah.
You know, your world has ended.
It's when you can't see beyond that 2 weeks and you think that the 2 weeks could become 22 years.
Oh, yes.
I guess that is intolerable. You know, most of us can put up with things for a couple of weeks or a few weeks. And, you know, Barney was still a lucky guy. He had everything going for him. But he just didn't see it.
Yes, well, of course, it's, you know, with you know, severe depression, I mean, that is, you know, the big issue, that Well, one of the really bad things about it is that you think this is all real. I'm not depressed. And this is going to last forever. And therefore,
you know, we get asked, some close friends will say, you know, what do you think about it? In other words, do you resent Barney? How do you feel? And the answer is no, not at all. I empathize, actually. I have a degree of admiration for him taking that decision. But at the same time, I sometimes look up and say, you're a selfish bastard.
Yeah.
And I think all those are natural and probably quite healthy feelings. But I'm not angry. I don't even feel guilty, although both Sheena and I feel that we could have done, you know, we could have been better parents. Of course we could, but then so could every parent. But we loved them, and we loved all our children, and we would have made mistakes. But actually, anger, guilt, and all that stuff is something we've been very lucky not to experience.
Well, I mean, it's a huge subject, and why I really wanted you to come on was this very conversation, because I just think it's very important for people to hear this. And, you know, you can take two views on suicide, can't you? You can say, well, it was an unselfish thing that someone did, or it's actually very selfish, or it's nothing to do with that.
And, of course, the answer, as with all things, lies in the middle somewhere.
Yeah, because of people left behind.
Well, interestingly, Jeremy, we found his text messages some a considerable time later, and he had texted his cousin, so my niece, and had told her that if the girl didn't come back, he was going to kill himself. And she had said, but what about your mother and father? What about your mum and dad? And he had just dismissed it. He had said something like, oh, they'll be fine. They're much stronger than me. And there is, I listened to a fascinating psychiatrist talk about one of the things about profound severe depression is that it dampens the hormones that produce fear and produce empathy. And if you take fear and empathy out of the equation and something awful has happened to you, what is left to stop you killing yourself?
Yes. Well, as a sort of sidetrack, but I want to know your view on this, that, you know, one of the things that I think is slightly crap is the way so much information is available on the internet. And, you know, I did this as an experiment. I went, how do I hang myself? I put that in Google. And it came out, the first one was, oh, don't do that, you know, go to the Samaritans. 2, 3, and 4 told you how to do it.
Mm. That's why I never share on my talks what happened.
Yeah.
Because I think that would be dangerous, frankly.
Yes.
You know, what would stop me is pure fear of it hurting or what happens next. And I do think that some of the stuff on the dark web, which I don't begin to understand, but even some stuff that, you know, you and I can access easily, does not reduce the risk of somebody choosing that option. And that's put delicately, because in fact, the more normalized it becomes, the more of an option it becomes.
Yeah.
So I agree with you.
Yeah, I totally get that. And I'm coming from the point of view who, you know, no, have been in those circumstances in my life. So, and that I hope is what is good about this podcast, is that there is some real verite, you know, authenticity here, you know.
Well, and I think that's really, really important. The fact that that people can talk about reality as they've experienced it. I read something, I think it was in the Times this morning or yesterday, about how it has now become increasingly common for celebrities to speak up about, like Prince Harry, for example, speaking up about his therapy and his drinking and his this, and various high-profile sportsmen have come out, and Nigel Owens about his sexuality, and this particular article was saying, yeah, it's great, but are we not beginning to glamorize the whole issue of suicidal thinking, suicide itself?
Yeah.
And I think that made me think about doing this talk, because I thought, who am I doing this for? Mm. Am I doing it for people that might listen and might take on board some of the stuff, and which is what one would hope, or am I actually doing it for me? And when I do my talks to parents, particularly, I'll say, I do these for two reasons. One is my own therapy. And two is that I hope something I might say might help one person look up when they're battered by a storm and think, it'll be okay. And I don't know the balance between whether I do it for me or for others.
Yeah. Well, I think the important thing is to tell the truth, actually. And I think I take the point about the glamorizing thing. It's like, well, you know, you try to do that. I try to, you know, it's also, you know, bloody hell. I mean, it's just quite funny, actually, in that way. But you know, I think the thing about people committing suicide is, you know, that that's it for them. They're bye-bye. You know,
they're fine.
They're all right. They're off. You know, wherever they're off to.
Yeah.
But very often, that leaves a lot of very unhappy people.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that's the real point. And also, it can be, as we've heard in Shed Talks, we've heard this, you know, with Roma Hooper. You know, she talked about being, you know, 9 years old, 10 years old when her father committed suicide, and the effects of that are long lasting. Mm.
And that's an important point, Jeremy, you make there, because Roma, you know, if when you lose a parent, age 9 or 10, the impact is massive and long lasting. When you lose a parent when you're adult, when you're 20 something, the impact is not necessarily, it may not be as great. Losing a child to suicide, everybody says, oh, terrible. But no suicide is the same.
Yeah.
No suicide is the same in terms of the reasons for it or the fallout from it. And one of the things that you and I have talked about in the past is silver linings. And it might seem an extraordinary thing to say, but I believe I am a happier person in 2021 than I was in 2010 before Barney died.
Yeah.
And why is that? Well, perhaps it's that Barney's suicide has helped me gain some fulfillment in possibly being able to help other people. That sounds really trite and rather nauseous in many ways, but it's true.
No, it doesn't. I mean, that's exactly what did happen to you. And I think, it, you know, I think it is unusual to go, actually, I'm a better person for that, you know. But that's just because one doesn't expect to hear that. You know, it's like, oh, no, I don't like that. Mm. But actually, that's the truth. And I think you said to me once that it made, you know, your marriage 50 times better. And
yep.
And you become closer to your kids, because it's cut the bullshit time, folks. You know, life is short.
Still doesn't make one a perfect parent or a perfect husband. But at least it gives you perspective, I think.
Yeah. It is very difficult trying to make sense of these situations. Do you have a view that, you know, it's nature, it's nurture? What do you think?
I have a very clear view that it's both. Fundamentally, sitting on the fence. Of course, the nurture side of things makes a fundamental difference. And obviously, the nurture also makes a fundamental difference. What I find so interesting, what I've learned, is how the nurture side of things can directly affect the nature side of things. So if I, as a parent, have one child, and then I have a particular experience, that that can actually change my genetic output so that when I have another child, the nature might be slightly different. Whereas I've always thought that, you know, how you bring somebody up, the environment, the circumstances, the experiences, the lifetime, will obviously be the most important. I now believe that it is far more complicated than that and goes back generations.
Yes.
And sometimes skips a generation, sometimes doesn't. There is no other explanation why sons numbers 1 and 3 have found life challenging and son numbers 2 and 4 have found it so straightforward. You know, if it had been sons 1 and 2 had been, you know, one type, but that isn't the case. So, you know, the whole attachment theories that were, you know, part of what, you know, Winnicott used to talk about attachment and the good enough mother is obviously seriously, seriously important and influences mm-hmm. things. But I also believe that there is a genetic element to the whole thing. And where the balance lies, I don't know, except I do know it lies in both.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating subject. And I think where you're really spot on is a common sense mixed with honesty policy is the best. So, you know, you went on, you know, one of the really good things that came out of this was you began speaking at schools on mental health subject and allied with Charlie Waller Memorial Trust. You know, that has been a very, very successful time for you. And that's how we met. So that was great. And, you know, that's sort of taken you also, you know, around the world, I think, including to Japan, if I'm right.
Yeah.
When I think there was something called Rugby World Cup was taking place.
No, you're right. That did happen to coincide with... yes, it did happen. Now you mention it.
It's really quite extraordinary.
It's an extraordinary coincidence.
Anyway, you know, what we you know, thank goodness we have a laugh. That's the really important thing.
Absolutely.
So, Dick, we have now arrived at the point in the Shed Talk where we get hold of your life jackets. And we sort of preempt these by getting, we find out what the life jackets are and then we talk about them. And interestingly, in terms of movies, I notice that Love Actually is in the first choice category, as it has been in a few other people's.
Mm.
So it's a very popular film, that.
It's a beautiful film. And it covers so much of what love really is. And I think people, you know, I'm a bit embarrassed putting Love Actually down because I know other people will put it down as well. And some people will think, actually, it's really naff. But every time I watch it, it makes me smile. It brings tears to my eyes. I can empathize with at least two of the characters. So I think it's absolutely lovely. It contrasts with one I didn't put down, with another favorite film, which is Zulu. Which could not be more different.
No, but that is a sensation.
Not much love in Zulu.
No, but it's a sensation.
But no, I think Love Actually is, and as far as a life jacket is concerned, love, whatever that may be, is actually one's main life jacket.
Yeah. And you've also put down Dead Poets Society. And of course, that's kind of interesting. It's interesting because, and I don't want to be prurient about suicide, but one of the boys in that film in his classroom ends up committing suicide because his father won't allow him to act, and the main actor, Robin Williams, sadly took his own life at the same time. So. I mean, I think it is a really great film myself, but tell me what your thoughts are.
Obviously, the suicide element, both of Robin Williams and of the boy in the film, particularly the sort of school that was portrayed in that film, very, very traditional, very old-fashioned. And you had this one teacher who came in who was something of a maverick, who was different, and who would have upset the apple cart, but who nonetheless was inspirational. But because he was not orthodox, he was rejected by the school and by some of the pupils, but certainly by the school and by some of the parents. And I hate to say it, but I see a parallel with that in a number of the schools I visit, that there's a way of doing things that gets us to the top of the tree in terms of educational standards that is unassailable. And anything that threatens that is a real threat and is probably to be done away with. Copied to that is the parent, the highly successful parent, who won't let his son play, I think it's Puck, Midsummer Night's Dream, and is the relationship between the father and the mother, and the refusal for the father to let this young man be who he is, also resonates in a big way with the expectations that particularly people like me, wealthy, middle class, Wimbledonians, the pressure that we actually put on our children, and whether in so obviously or not. And the final reason why I love it, and I could watch this all the time, is when Robin Williams is sacked after the boy's death, because he is obviously to blame for this boy wanting to act, or so people are led to believe. And he goes into his classroom to pick up some books, and the headmaster's teaching in a very, very traditional orthodox way. And he picks up some books, and as he goes out, one of the boys stands on his chair. Says, "My captain, my captain."
That's right.
And then they all do, and he just looks and says, "Thank you, boys." And I just think that is one of the most moving, probably the most moving moment in film that I know of.
Yes. I'd forgotten that. And in fact, the actor who played the headmaster has just died, actually, aged 104. But the only thing I'm going to add to that is that what my experience of, going around schools and talking and all this sort of stuff, is that I think there's a great danger that parents will not allow their children to fail. And I think that's, I know that's contentious probably with all the things we've talked about, but, you have to let people fail.
It's absolutely essential, and we have to prepare them. We have to talk about, you want to get into Oxford, but how are you going to feel? Let's talk about how you'll feel if you don't.
Exactly.
Will it be the end of your life? Well, of course it bloody well won't, but I do feel it's going to take generations to change the expectations that we have. Because, our children are our most precious, and I hesitate to use the word possession, but they are the most precious thing in our lives. And what we want more than anything else is for them to be happy. And we sometimes mistakenly think that happiness is to do with academic and financial success. Rather than being who you are, whether you're straight or gay or trans or black or white, or being content in your own skin and being who you are rather than the person your parents want you to be or your teachers want you to be or who society says you should be. I think that is massive.
Yeah. Did you ever take part in a film called If?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Filmed, I think, at Cheltenham College.
Correct. Okay, Dick, on that note, I want you to talk me through Ashokan Farewell, Genesis. Sugon. What's that?
It was one of the songs in Empire of the Sun that the boy sing, or the tune plays as the boy is watching the last Japanese kamikaze pilots take off into the sun.
Oh, right, yes.
And it is the most beautiful, I don't know what it is really, is it an anthem or is it, but it's just incredibly simple and incredibly beautiful. As for the Ashokan Farewell, it was the theme tune to Burns's documentary on the American Civil War. And it accompanies, again, for anybody listening to this, if you look up Sullivan Ballou Letter, he was a captain in, I think, the 3rd Maine Infantry in the Union Army, who, just before one of the earliest battles of Bull Run, wrote home to his wife a love letter, basically, talking about what would happen if he died. And it brings tears to my eyes even thinking about it. And needless to say, he's killed at the battle.
Oh, right. Right.
And it's a piece of, I guess it starts with a bit of fiddle music, and it's beautiful. And as far as Genesis goes, well, when I was, I don't know, I suppose early 70s, my favourite memories are going to see Genesis play live at Newcastle Civic Hall and at various other places, and the mystical Peter Gabriel, who's one of the people I would love to meet, and their early albums, Foxtrot, Trespass, Nursery Crimes, I just think are, for me, part of my growing up.
Okay, that's excellent. Rules for Old Men Waiting, Peter Pouncey.
Have you read it?
I haven't. No, I haven't. I may get it as a result of this.
Yeah. No. Do. It was my one reason is my father recommended it. My father recommended a lot of the best books I've ever read. He was a great reader. And it is about an ex-Scottish rugby international who is a professor at an American university and has married an American woman. The woman dies and the professor has retired, and he lives in quite a ramshackle old house that is gradually, with age, falling apart, as is he. Uh-huh. And he sets himself certain rules whilst he's waiting to die.
All right.
It is a mixture of desperately moving but very funny.
Right.
Some great little anecdotal things that many of us will be able to empathise with. And it's a lovely, lovely book. Short, simple, beautiful.
I'm going to get that. That sounds really good. Okay, now, we always try and bring out the inner gardener in you, in our guests, but clearly that's not going to happen in this. Anyway, we thank you for reading from Making Love to Mother Earth, my grandfather's book, which everyone's going to be able to hear quite soon. So, fly fishing is a... I never knew that about you. Are you a keen fly fisher?
Yep, I am. I'm not completely obsessed. I've always been keen on fishing, but I learned to fly fish when I was 18. I learned with Sheena by a wonderful old man called Frank Sawyer, who was a sort of doyen of traditional fly fishermen. And I was really lucky to have fly fishing on my doorstep through my 20s. And I love it. I'm not frankly too bothered about catching fish, but being by a riverbank, at this time of year, with growth and green and the smell of nettles and is very, very special. I've taken to becoming very keen on single-handed salmon fishing, and last year for the first time I went to Iceland with two friends and my number two son, and it was a stunning experience. The peace, the tranquility, was just
wonderful. Well, funnily enough, it's another thing you have in common with Roma Hooper. She's big on that. And so I'm not sure whether she'll be joining you zooming around Wimbledon Common on your bike, on your e-bike, but she would with Mango and Myrtle, your English setters, which I know you're pretty religious about walking with.
Yeah, I am. I mean, not walking in the proper sense of the word, sort of stumbling is probably a better expression. And Mango and Myrtle have been banished from this room while I'm doing this chat with you. Myrtle is suffers severely from ADHD. I don't mean to be, you know, say that and in any detrimental sense, because she's lovely and gorgeous, but she is very high maintenance. Uh-huh. Whereas her friend Mango is laid back and calm and cool and funny. And as you know, Jeremy, pets are reassuring.
Yeah.
That's the best way of putting it, I think. And children, when I ask groups of children for their what I call mind apples, you've probably heard of mind apples, things that will just give them a glimmer of a smile or a piece of hope or a piece of a deep breath. What gives you that moment? And an awful lot of them will say talking to my cat or playing with my dog. And when I ask why, they say, well, because they always understand. And they're never judgmental.
Yeah, unconditional love, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Just like a mother, really, in most cases.
Well, what can I say? Well, Dick, you know, it has been really good having you in the shed, even though it's raining now.
Ah, well, you see, you shouldn't live in the west of the country, you see. You should live up here in the smoke.
Listen, Wincanton is the centre of the universe. I want to ask you this. If that 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 14-year-old boy that was you or someone very similar came to see you today and said, listen, you know, I am fed up, but I think I've got some hope. What three things might you say to them that could make a difference?
Wow. I wish you'd warned me about that one. Okay. Well, the first one I'd say is that life is a mixture of ups and downs, and the downs can be pretty powerfully horrible storms. And you know what? There's never been a storm that has stayed in one place, geographical or emotional. And that storm will pass. It will pass more quickly if you will lean on somebody else or other people. And it might not be your parents. It might be your big sister. It might be Jeremy Thomas. It might be somebody else who you can lean on that will help you think through all the emotions that are all over the place. And the third thing I would say is don't let a day go by without laughing. Or at least grinning. And I say quite often to them, I said, look, if you're getting into bed, I said, do me a favor, over the next week, every time you're getting into bed, just stop and say, have I had a laugh today? Has anything made me smile or giggle? And if the answer is no, don't get into bed. Go and find a computer, go onto YouTube and watch stupid cats or fainting goats or whatever it is that rocks your boat and makes you laugh. Because if you can get into bed having had something of a moment of levity, that will set you up for a better night's sleep. And a better night's sleep will lead to a better day tomorrow.
Great, Dick. That's really tip-top and totally tidy.
I would, of course, say the other thing you could do is to phone up Jeremy Thomas and, you know, have a chat. And you never know, you might even be invited to have a look inside his shed. And that will cheer you up.
Yes. Dick, thank you so much. You're a rocker, a groovy person who makes our groovometers all exceed 9.5. Thank you so much. And I look forward to the next Six Nations rugby. And this, you know, next trip, the British Lions. And ribbing you if I can. And just generally seeing you for lots and lots of laughs.
It is always great fun talking to you, Jeremy. And this has been pretty special for me. Bit emotional, but pretty damn special. So thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you. And goodbye. We are absolutely delighted to welcome back from her celebrity appearance on Shed Talks, Karen Cowan. Karen.
Hi, very nice to be back and great to hear Dick talking. It was really fascinating.
It was a really, really good talk, I thought. And, you know, I just thought he was very honest and articulate and emotionally sort of intelligent, really. But, you know, very keen to see what you thought. And I thought, you know, just diving in, that, you know, one of the things I think is extraordinary about Dick was that he grew up as this very tough rugby player, very, very good player. You know, you don't get picked to play for England schoolboys unless you are. And yet he had all of this, you know, self-harm issue going on. What did you make of that?
Well, I felt that he obviously had a very, very tough time at school. We didn't hear all that much about his parents and his childhood, and it sounded like the self-harming, a lot of it was to get ill and be taken away from school, because it was a really tough school with that tough headmaster and so on. And it was a strange anomaly because there was this frightened little boy who was also a tough rugby player, and in a way it shows us that you can be everything. You can be a tough rugby player and be scared, and I think swallowing the things, saying that he had appendicitis, were really kind of ways of not only expressing his fear but also of getting away from the tyrannic headmaster. But I think it must have added to Dick's ability to try to understand teenagers and young people, and perhaps that's why he ended up with the job he did have.
Yes.
And I'm sure he was a lot more gentle than his own headmaster.
Yes.
And he was able to learn, as he said himself, that there is a silver lining in the end, and that he did come out of school and he did start to have a nice time, and he did meet Sheena, who he described very much as his rock and very much needing her. I noticed, but perhaps there wasn't time, we didn't hear very much about Sheena, his wife, and Barney and the boys about there.
That was unfortunate. It would have been great to have known about her.
Yes. And just, it sounds like their relationship is very strong, and it sounds like the family, after Barney's death, were able to kind of regroup, because it often takes a lot of rebalancing after something like that. And in a way, because there was, you know, three children sort of left, as it were, and them together, it was kind of protective, perhaps, in a way, that they kind of had to kind of work on regrouping together. And again, we didn't hear much about Sheena, but the general underlying feeling was that that Dick sees Sheena very much as his rock, and perhaps the person who really helped the family get back together again after such an enormous trauma as Barney's untimely death.
Yes, I think I got that impression. Yeah. And of course, you know, what is really fantastic about Dick Moore doing Shed Talks is that he makes it sound like easy peasy, I can talk about this. And I mean, it's a really tricky subject to be able to talk about, as you know, lucidly and in a completely non-bullshit manner.
Yes.
I thought, you know, because I've always thought this, it's a terrible thing for parents and other members of family to be left when someone, you know, one sibling has taken their own life. And I thought what he spoke about was extraordinary. I mean, talking about how it all happened. And, well, that in itself, I think, was quite unusual, that Barney had been with this girl for some time and it had just, you know, developed into a sort of, well, I don't know whether this is true, developed into an obsession. But when she decided to break it up, it then was an obsession that he couldn't do without. And I mean, we've all heard of that, haven't we? I mean, in times.
Yes, and it's particularly common in young adults, of course. And yes, just going back to what you said at the beginning, yes, Dick is exceptional in being able to speak about it so openly. And I mean, a lot of people are afraid to speak about it sometimes because they're afraid of what their interviewer or questioner might say and whether the questioner might say something upsetting. But back to Barney and his love affair. Of course, you know, he was under 25 and the brain really takes a long time to form, you know, until it's 25. And he also would have had less experience that things do get better. So with the brain immaturity and the perhaps the inability to see that this isn't actually the end of the world, there's something on the other side, must have been so difficult for Barney.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, but that's the point, isn't it? That you know, why would you know that apart from what people are telling you? And if you feel it so acutely, as he did, then he's just going, well, it doesn't matter. I can't. Yeah. You know.
Yes, of course, and he feels that the relationship is absolutely everything to him, and he has. It sounds like fairly minimal life experience of loss. And so the idea that he would recover from this loss is sort of untenable to him. And that's so sad. And I'm not sure if it's something we can try to kind of instill in our young people. I mean, I certainly know there's a lot of research to show, for example, that children who've lost a grandparent, a close grandparent, or someone close to them, find it much easier later on if someone dies because they've learnt it does end. Whereas I'm imagining that Barney hadn't learnt that things do end, and perhaps no amount of telling him at that time would have worked, really.
Yes, but can I put an idea to you that, you know, if you say that the roots of this could rest in, you know, poor self-esteem, poor self-worth, and that very often people who basically may not feel any good about themselves at all, they just think they're really deep down, they're really crap, and therefore they go from relationship to relationship because it's telling them that's where they get their worth, their self-worth. Do you see a parallel with that?
Well, I can't really tell because Dick didn't really talk about that aspect of it. But, you know, it may be that he got a lot of self-esteem from his relationship, and it may well be that he saw how marvellous his parents' relationship was and really wanted that and was searching for that and was searching to replicate that.
Mm. I think, you know what I think was really good here, and I'm really repeating myself, I know, but is to have somebody talk about the effect of suicide, how it led up to it, what actually happened, what happened afterwards and now, is so useful because, I mean, I can think, you know, in my own family, going back a long, long, long time, somebody committed suicide. And it was a state secret for 60, 70 years. And you think to yourself, I'm not saying you only have to be jolly hockey sticks. Oh, goody, you know, Johnny committed suicide. Let's all have a, you know, chat about it. But that aspect of actually everybody understanding what's happened so that silver linings can come from it.
Silver linings can come from it. And also that the stigma around suicide is broken just by Dick doing these talks, talking about it.
Yeah.
It kind of helps other people very, very much who might have been affected by suicide, but it also helps people thinking about how might I be able to ameliorate the possibility of someone's suicide. Of course, it's very, very difficult to stop, as Dick pointed out, to stop people killing themselves if they really want to.
Yeah.
But I think Dick's openness about it does go a long way towards cracking the stigma of suicide. And there's often a lot of judgment around suicide, a lot of guilt from the parents, which is often unnecessary. A lot of anger. And also the other thing that's so important for young people to hear is that, and very difficult for them to believe, but the more you say something, the more they might believe it, is that you leave behind some very sad people, plus, you know, the pain would have ended and you would have had, almost certainly had, a great life. Not every bit of it would have been great, but you would have done. It's about the pain passing, I think, is something really important for young people to know about.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think in a way, you know, my thing that I would say, and this is really what I want to get in, I suppose, is that, you know, no matter how shameful you feel, or that, you know, you're being made to feel, and no matter how sort of it's over, it's finished, this is never going to go, you know, try talking to somebody, choose somebody good, but talk to them. And it could be, you know, it doesn't have to be a psychiatrist.
It can be the Samaritans, a friend, somebody sitting next to you on the bus, somebody sitting next to you on the train.
Yes.
And it's not forever. And it's also another really important thing is look, I want to kill myself. Let me see if I can get through the next 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then the next 5 minutes, and then the next 5 minutes.
I think the Samaritans are not to be underestimated, and they're not.
They really are not to be. That is exactly what they're there for, yes.
Yeah, but they're also, the good thing about Samaritans is that you actually don't, a lot of people misunderstand them. You think, oh, I've got to be standing on the 9th floor of a high building, ready to jump, and then I can talk to them. You don't. You can talk to them whenever.
Yes.
And they're good, trained people.
Yes.
And, you know, you go and talk to a priest. You can, you know, somebody at school.
Or ringing other helplines for teenagers and young people. Yeah. You know, I'm not sure if the Charlie Waller Trust have a helpline.
Yes, they do. They do. They do, actually, yeah. Also, you, by talking to somebody, you expose it and yourself and the problem to the light and to oxygen. And, you know, by getting it outside, it can get right-sized, as opposed to being huge in your head 24/7.
Yes.
And that can really help.
Yes.
Well, that's absolutely brilliant. It's been another fantastic episode of Shed Talks, episode 6, with Karen Cowan. I love that. And because we're very human people deep down, we wish Bryony Brooke, a very happy birthday, because it's her birthday today.
Happy birthday, Bryony.
Yes. And we'll be back, and, you know, check out the website jeremythomastalks.co.uk, Shed Talks, and send in any suggestions, things that we could be doing that are much better. And we'll be back very, very soon. Kaz, Karen, thank you so much for being a top sport and our top person.
Well, thank you very much, and it was a great privilege to listen to both you and Dick Moore talking. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.
Thank you to Stuart Bagshaw, our top engineer editor. Thank you to B. Brooke, our top administrator, production manager. Thank you to Karen Cowan, our top psychologist. If you want to find out more about Shed Talks, visit our website, jeremythomastalks.co.uk. Please sign up to the newsletter. If you want to write to us or find out anything about anybody or contact anyone on the show, inquiries@jeremythomastalks.co.uk. You can find us on Facebook at Shed Talks, Shed Talks Twitter at JT Shed Talks, Instagram
@jeremythomastalks. So it's all been tip top and totally tidy. Stay safe, be groovy. Please sign up, support, and share this. Thanks a lot. Goodbye.